Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR, and we're listening to What's Next. With us, author, PR individual, and many other hats that John Masalonis wears. John, thanks for joining us.
Jay, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Your book is Walking Each Other Home, Zachary's Mission, a hospice for children. We'll certainly want to get into the book and talk about that as well. But you have brought to our attention that there are over 4,000 children in this country diagnosed with a terminal disease each year. And inside of that number, it says 70% of parents struggle with having those discussions about death. I would say very understandable. But let's maybe just break that down, what you understand that is blocking perhaps these important conversations, obviously very important conversations when it comes to this discussion inside a family.
I agree. And it's interesting because we want life to be rainbows and gumdrops, but life has its polarity and its contrast. And the things that are the most difficult can be the most challenging in the process. And especially with those families who have a terminally ill child, it can even be beyond cumbersome to even initiate that conversation. Or even if you just have a little one that's coming into the world, they're getting of age, how do you have that conversation? One of the reasons why I love the work that you do at your station and through NPR, a big source of inspiration in my life has been Fred Rogers, the host of the long-running children's television program, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, iconic. Still, in the research that I was doing in the creation of my children's book, still one of the main go-to resources for parents and caregivers and educators when they talk to children about death, grief, and loss was the episode when Fred talked about the loss of his goldfish. There was a certain way in which Fred communicated about that in a very non-judgmental, compassionate way where he spoke to the heart of children. He didn't talk above them. He didn't talk below them. And he realized that these conversations needed to be had. Now, of course, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood isn't in existence anymore, but we still feel Fred's memory and his spirit. And it's interesting because in coming into your studios here and traveling cross country from San Diego, one of my dearest friends is David Newell,
right,
who played Mr. McFeely on Mr. Rogers'
right.
Neighborhood. And him and I, we actually co-host one of the longest running, most popular children's book review programs for children, parents, educators, and librarians called the Neighborly Reviews Bookcast. When I was even communicating with him leading into the creation of my book, and he even mentioned about the importance of having these kinds of conversations and just allowing the emotions to be felt, allow the feelings to be felt in the process, because if we don't have these conversations with our kids right now, they're going to learn about it in maybe some sort of a more disempowered way. And we can do our part as parents and caregivers and custodians of our children to really provide that safe space and at least initiate these conversations with them and keep the conversation going so it's not necessarily a taboo subject.
It's also interesting as well, another connection for you, the inspiration for this book comes from a significant death in your life.
Yes, my grandmother, Jane Sajecki, Buffalo, huge Polish community. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we refer to our grandmothers as Babcia.
Right.
So Babcia's grandmother, Jadzia's grandfather. And my grandmother was my rock in many respects. And growing up, I can look back now and say that she unconditionally loved me just the way that I was. And she always provided inspiration, motivation. She always wanted to make sure that I was okay. She had passed in the summer of 2013. I was already kind of moving through some health challenges before her passing. This is where really, sometimes people use the term spiritual awakening. That tends to happen with someone where it's kind of like you move through life, you drive down the same streets, and things look different, sound different, feel different. And it crushed me in many respects. And shortly after she passed, there was also a testicular cancer diagnosis that I was given.
Right.
And I remember receiving the news from my urologist, literally across the street from where I received the diagnosis is where my grandmother and grandfather are buried. And I went over to the cemetery and I went to my grandmother's space and I said, I surrender. I said, I need to know what it is to do. And shortly after that, it felt pretty clear that my tour of duty, as I like to say here in West New York, my time here was drawing to a close. And it started becoming very prevalent for me to be able to move out to the West Coast, to move to San Diego. There's something very sacred to me about that area in many respects. And to be able to begin the next steps of my mission out there and to eventually help create and facilitate and build a hospice for children. So step one was getting out to San Diego. Step two was getting settled into San Diego. And step three was write and then publish this book in the process to be able to do my part to be able to help grieving families in Western New York, in Southern California, but also across the country and around the world.
But you also had some professional experience as well here in Western New York, connecting wrestlers with Children's Hospital. That was then, of course, Children's Hospital on Bryant Street, of course, has since moved and been rebranded as Oshai Children's Hospital. But
correct.
Take us inside those interactions.
One of the Earth Angels, and we'll talk a little bit more about the book as well, too, but one of the Earth Angels is this in the story is Jane, the loving grandmother. So again, profound influence on my life. But the man who introduced me to Oshai Children's Hospital and even the predecessor in the process is Dennis DiPaolo, who many know and love as the true heart and soul of Ilio DiPaolo's Italian restaurant.
Took over for his father, right?
In Blaisdell. And so he introduced me during my time as the host of the award-winning wrestling radio show Monday Night Mayhem. And so for over 10 years, I interviewed some of the top names in the world of professional wrestling and sports and entertainment. And I can look back and say that the two biggest takeaways from my time there, it wasn't, you know, traveling across the country to see five WrestleManias or interviewing these larger than life, mythical like figures of sorts. It was the relationship with Dennis, who became very much a father figure to me, but also being introduced to Children's Hospital. And I learned that each major children's hospital has what's known as a child life department.
Okay.
And they provide emotional support and entertainment for children who are going through cancer, dialysis, and recovering from surgeries. So whenever the wrestlers, the then three major wrestling companies, and they're all still in existence now, the WWE, TNA Wrestling, and Ring of Honor, when the wrestlers would come through Buffalo, I would be the one to coordinate and say, hey, we've got such and such and so-and-so superstar coming in. Can they visit the kids? Can they go room to room?
Is there one visit that you recall? The one stands out?
It was a couple of them, actually. The memories in the world of wrestling kind of all blend together, to speak. But really, it took me some time after the whole experience to really realize, like, wow, there's something very profound about that, because I remember, for me, oftentimes it's about the feelings and how I felt then and over time. But the children's faces would light up. They would see these more than likely, you know, superhero figures to them wearing the shiny gold belts and the muscle shirts. And they were able to, albeit for a moment, know that everything was going to be okay. And their families were able to get some support in the process as well, too. And so I know that, you know, professional wrestling and sports entertainment over the years kind of get some bad raps, but the work that they do, especially for children, is absolutely paramount. But again, there's times in your life when you move through experiences and you help people along the way. You don't necessarily know how that comes full circle. And again, it's literally been 12 years since I wrapped up my time as the host of Monday Night Mayhem. And now it's just interesting to see how things come full circle. Like, if it wasn't for professional wrestling, I wouldn't have met Dennis DiPaolo. I wouldn't have met the team at Children's Hospital. I wouldn't have received the vision of moving out to San Diego and wanting to help create and facilitate a children's hospice. And if anything, initiate this conversation so that grieving families know that they're not alone, that they're loved, that they're cared for, and that they're appreciated right where they're at on their path.
Dennis DiPaolo, I appreciate you talking about him. I'm curious about what you see inside him that is, you use the term father figure. What make that connection for us?
In many respects, I can probably say that I would not be here, literally and figuratively, if it were not for Dennis. When I was moving through some challenging times in my life, kind of akin to my grandmother, Dennis saw me unconditionally for who I was, maybe what I was not necessarily moving through in that moment. He knew that I would be able to overcome whatever that thing or things were. I always like to say that, you know, when I was moving through those times, Dennis literally lent me his belief in me and said, why don't you try this on for size? And I even remember when he first came to the WBNY studios, which is, of course, you know, Buffalo State College, now Buffalo State University. That's where Monday Night Mayhem had its early origins. He came in with Dick the Destroyer Byer into the studios, and he said, there's something about this John guy. And ultimately, just being able to, when I would take the time, go to the restaurant, have conversations with him, it was something to look forward to. And in life, when you're moving through this, that, or the other, ultimately, when you can have at least a thing to look forward to, it's almost like a saving grace in many respects. And to be able to now look back on 22 years, if I'm not mistaken, plus, and knowing Dennis, the fact of all the support that he pledged over the years, this is why it's really important for me. I mean, you know, Dennis is a very humble man. And when I told him, I said, listen, Dennis, you're now forever immortalized in a children's book. He's humbled and he's grateful for that. But it's just so fascinating how our relationship went from the world of wrestling. And even then, during our time, like, we helped to raise money for Children's Hospital, for the DiPaolo Scholarship Foundation, different other children's charities. And now we're doing our part to align in an even stronger way to be able to let grieving families know that there's support that's out there for you in the process.
We're talking with John Masalonis today. He's the author of Walking Each Other Home, Zachary's Mission, a hospice for children, here on What's Next. So Dennis is inside the book. He's a figure inside the book. When it comes to putting this together, was it important for you to try to include all these different characters, symbols, or is it something that kind of came out of a different place for you and just kind of emerged?
This was so representing many prominent children's authors in the world of children's literature for well over a decade now. This is something, when I knew that this story had to come out, that it needed to be very specially curated. And I had this idea for the story for probably about 7 or 8 years. And you've probably seen this in your life. Oftentimes, there that you say you're going to do something, and then you repeatedly say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. Eventually,
it's always future.
Eventually, you get to a point where you need to do the thing that you say that you're going to do. And so specifically with this book, there's the term that I use in the story called earth angels. And I feel if someone is religious, they get it. If they're spiritual, they get it. Maybe even if they're not, they do. Because there's people that come into our lives, whether it be to simply to inspire us or to lift our spirits or to really help us when we're moving through the most challenging times of our life. Some people call it the divine storm, when this, that, and the other, where anything and everything that could go wrong is going wrong. And so that was one of the important pieces, to be able to weave in Jane, the loving grandmother, into the story, and Dennis, the beloved Italian restaurateur. And then also people in my journey once I moved cross country to San Diego. So one of the other earth angels in the story is Georgianne, the animal loving storyteller, who's actually inspired by Georgianne Irvine, who is one of the longest tenured employees at the San Diego Zoo. She is the award winning creator of the zoo's Hope and Inspiration collection. So she chronicles many of the animals and their journeys at the zoo that have gone through challenging circumstances circumstances and have come through to the other side. And then also Patrick, the Reiki master, who is actually one of my former practitioners on my end of things. So the importance of reminding people that we all have earth angels that come into our lives that help us throughout the course of our life to get us to where it is that we need to be and to help us fulfill our missions and our purpose as well, too. And, you know, oftentimes in children's books, you find like redeeming life lessons as well, too. The importance of, even though Zachary, who is the main character in the story, and it's also important that I mention because people have asked me, was there a Zachary in your life? Was there a real life child who passed from cancer? Thankfully, no. At the same point, when I knew that the main character would kind of have this journey, there was only one person who came to mind. Zachary, the 8-year-old boy in the story, is inspired by Zachary Beveridge, who is actually a former longtime friend of mine. He was the former street team president of my wrestling radio show, Monday Night Mayhem. He had actually passed well over a decade ago from a heart condition, I believe. And I stayed in close proximity with his family over the years, and it was important for me to be able to honor his memory as well, too, so that that lives on in the process. But one of the things is that Zachary, even though he's moving through a cancer diagnosis, he learns through a dream that he has this mission that's been given to him of helping to create, facilitate, and build a children's hospice in La Jolla, California, which many people refer to as the Jewel of San Diego. And he's not alone. He has these four earth angels that help him along the way. But along the way, Jay, they also help to teach him about the different meanings of unconditional love. So, for example, Jane, the loving grandmother, communicates and shares with Zachary how unconditional love can look like, sound like, and feel like spending quality time with the ones that you love. And Dennis, the beloved Italian restaurateur, teaches Zachary that unconditional love can look like, sound like, and feel like cooking a meal for someone who's hungry, someone in need, serving others, even in the most difficult, challenging right. times of your life. This is one of the reasons why, again, I also love the work that you and your team do here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media and that NPR. You provide a service, and the importance of providing services to those people that are in need. Georgianne reminds Zachary how unconditional love can look like, sound like, and feel like, helping kids connect with their creativity, their imagination, and their inner spark. And Patrick helps Zachary to remember that unconditional love can simply be lifting someone up when they feel down. So one of the reasons why I'm very blessed and very fortunate about this book and what it's doing right now is the fact that people from different walks of life, whether it be different ages, races, ethnicities, faiths, even though they may have their own certain core of belief, so to speak, there's a takeaway that they can extract from the book and they can move forward into their own lives with it, especially if their life has been touched by grief and loss, whether it be the loss of a child or just a loss that impacted them in any way, shape, or form. Because, Jay, we all grieve. Whether we're short, tall, blonde, or blue, as the expression goes, we all grieve. We live in a very divisive country now more than ever before. We live in a divisive world. And if we can just do our part when someone grieves to take the time and say, hey, how you doing? How are you feeling? Or I hope you feel better, and actually mean it, just to be able to, so that person on the other end can feel it in a more visceral way. This is just some of the reasons why it was important for me to be able to blend all this together in this children's book, because for me, it's not just about writing a book. It's a combination of sharing my story. It's honoring the earth angels that came through into my life, and especially helping grieving families to remember that they're not forgotten, that we're really thinking about them now, and that life will be able to move forward for them while still being able to honor the memory of their child.
The book opens up with Zachary's family getting the diagnosis that he has cancer. I'm wondering, are those conversations you've explored perhaps with practitioners as well, what that's like for them to have to be the one to give such a just an awful statement to people, especially when there's a young child involved?
I'm actually glad that you mentioned that. You know, ultimately, practitioners who are taking care of children who are terminally ill, or if they're finding out that they are terminally ill, they want to be able to provide as much help and support as possible. And I know, and this is one of the things that I've been also communicating with families and with practitioners as well, too, is that a large premise of the story is about Zachary fulfilling his mission and the importance of that. And ultimately, through the story, people are able to kind of create their own interpretations, so to speak, as well, too. Obviously, even though Zachary is given the terminal cancer diagnosis, everyone is still doing their part to keep Zachary as comfortable as possible and to prolong his life as much as possible. And so, you know, one of the reasons is that I can admit, even creating this story, I kind of had to move through my own, who am I to share this message? Mm-hmm. I'm not a doctor or a nurse or a grief counselor or a priest or a rabbi or a clergyman.
But you have personal experience in this.
I do have personal
experience. Eight when you got your diagnosis, but
I have personal experience, but I'm a man who cares about children, a man who cares about grieving families as well too. And it's interesting because I know that, you know, people have kind of compared my journey a little bit to that of Fred Rogers and Danny Thomas, who's the founder of St. Jude Children's Hospital. He was just a man who wanted to help kids in the process and to utilize his platform for the highest and greatest good. So just to be able to have this be a resource of care for practitioners, for families in the process, knowing the fact that their child is leaving a lasting legacy. Obviously, we're so used to the fact when our children are here, like you and I, for example, like we're having this conversation in real time. I can see you, you can see me, you can hear me. But when someone isn't here physically, it takes a little bit of an adjustment period. The importance of Zachary's family in the story, knowing the fact that even though Zachary is moving through this, that he's really going to be helping children and parents and families beyond the scope of his life. There's so many different things tied into this story, but especially with the fact that it is now being able to help practitioners out there and parents who have children who are moving through the toughest challenge of life. This is something that I just encourage, not even just grieving families, but also practitioners to be able to lean into even further, because obviously everyone has their own resources that they're able to utilize. But this is one of the things that I'm actually glad that you touched upon as well. The importance, there's something about children's books. And it's interesting because the number of authors who have come into my life over the years who have written books about death, grief, and loss, oftentimes there's something really is almost kind of magical about children's books, where if, let's say, there's a practitioner who may not necessarily know how to communicate, they want to communicate things in a certain way, you have the children's book be the conversation starter. So if anything, even if you're not necessarily looking at it too much into the analytical perspective, just basically knowing the fact that everything will be okay, your loved ones are going to be okay, and we're going to do our part to prolong your life as much as possible.
And well, John, I appreciate the aspirations. It's notable and most certainly admirable for sure. The name of the book is Walking Each Other Home, Zachary's Mission, a Hospice for Children, available in most standard means, I assume, right?
Yep. So you can head on over to my official website, johnmassalonis.com. You can also go to amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com by heading over to Amazon. Just one of the things that I love about your station and NPR, you support authors. And when you leave those reviews for authors, they really help in the process. I'm very fortunate to, of course, been here in Western New York for the next leg of my national book tour. So copies of my book are also available at Ilio DiPaolo's restaurant, in addition to Barnes & Noble and Clarence, The Bookworm in East Aurora. So obviously, if you want to pledge your support for any of those amazing places in the process, and as I always like to say, to support your local libraries, your favorite children's and independent bookstores, if they don't stock their copies of Walking Each Other Home, Zachary's Mission, a Hospice for Children, make that kind recommendation that they do. And this really is a full circle moment. I want to mention this in our closing time together, the fact that literally 5 years since I've moved out here, and just I'm really doing my part to celebrate all of this. And again, if it would not be possible for all of the people that have come along on my path, because even though there's a lot of success and many blessings that I'm having in my life, I'm a firm believer that I am here. I stand on the shoulders of those who came here before me and who helped me to learn to love myself and become the person whom I am today.
Earth angels, right?
That's right.
Yeah, very good. John Massalonis, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks again, Jay. Really enjoyed our conversation today.
When we return, we'll sit down with Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis of Walking Through Solutions. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
What do classical symphonies, in-depth news, dramas, DIY, and your favorite indie bands have in common? They're all part of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. We've updated our station names to reflect the big picture. BTPM PBS, BTPM NPR, BTPM Classical, BTPM The Bridge, BTPM Create, and BTPM PBS Kids. Different formats, one mission: to serve our cross-border community. Learn more at btpm.org.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media produced a short documentary on creative restorations, which delivers life-saving supplies to combat overdose in Western New York.
Because we're a new agency, what happens sometimes is, you know, a lot of grant funders, they are hesitant to fund you. So we were on the fence with getting the grant before I sent them the video. It was able to show the grant funder what exactly their money was going to go towards. With that grant, that allowed us to secure a home base. Now we have a location where we do community meals, where we provide services right then and there. So I think the importance is you guys were able to really put boots on the ground with us, really show the city in a lens that you don't commonly see. So I think it helps to raise awareness to some of the issues that we have in our city, but also what else left do we have to do as a community to better our community? Please, if you can, fund public media. Make sure that they're available because they really put a harder focus on the community. And it really gives a better view of what we really need to get done here.
Contact Congress now at protectmypublicmedia.org.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR, and this is What's Next. My name is Jay Moran. With me, a couple of familiar guests with us from Walking Through Solutions, Deja Middlebrook. Deja, hi.
Thank you for having me.
Always great to have you along. And LaShawn Davis, great to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Always a pleasure. First, we got to start off with the congratulations to Deja Middlebrook, because Deja just passed the New York State bar exam.
Thank you. Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
We could probably talk about that the whole show, but that's not why you guys came here. You got to keep in mind also, not only is Deja got her JD, but she also has her LMSW, just like mom.
Yes.
Yes.
And LMSW stands for?
Licensed Master Level Social Worker.
Yes. And of course, Walking Through Solutions, you guys are, well, LaShawn, I guess you're the founder, right? Is
yes.
that fair enough to say?
Yes.
What prompted
yes.
you to start it?
I felt there was a need for more counselors of color. That was my passion. I just really wanted to help. A lot of services were for people who were of a lower income, and I really wanted to help those be aware of mental health that were in a middle income or a higher income, let them know that services was out there for them.
It's interesting how you say be aware.
Mm-hmm.
The awareness was low before. It's
yes.
increasing, you believe?
Yes, I do. And it was a stigma with it. You know, mental health is for people who have life struggles or not surviving in life, where I wanted, you know, everyone deals with mental health struggles. Every family, every person. So I just wanted to put it out there and give the education on it, because a lot of people don't know. They assume, even like students I work with are like, oh, something's wrong with these people. And I'm like, no, everybody has mental health.
Right, right. So it's good to see that it's there. And through that mission, of course, it brings us to why one of the reasons why you're here is that you're going to bring community conversations
yes.
into the East Side. I mean, obviously, it's been a big part of what you've been doing. But
yes.
but in this particular case, in the month of May, which is what, Mental Health Awareness Month,
yes.
you've got a series of conversations coming up on the East Side. Let's talk about that.
Yes, we have our Walking Through Solution Wednesdays, which is coming up.
Yes.
And we are partnering with other entrepreneurs to come in and talk about their expertise. We also started off with we partnered with University of Buffalo School of Social Work and the City of Buffalo, who has allowed our interns to work with us, both of us and the city. And they have worked with families. They've done groups.
They've done research.
They worked under us. Yes, they did a lot of research. So we're going to start the kickoff with them so they can talk about what they've learned and how they've learned more about trauma-informed care and how to push it out to the community.
Yeah, so the kickoff is a 5-part series. The kickoff is going to be free. We want to make sure that everyone can come to here to showcase our interns. It's like their capstone to show this is what they've done for the city, this is what they've learned individually, and then how you can apply it in your day-to-day life if you're working with youth or families. And even just at home in general.
Right.
But the 5-part series, we've partnered, like she said, with a lot of local entrepreneurs to add some other voices to the conversation, people who they specialize in, are experts in those specific topics. And it ranges because, just like my mom said, my business partner mom.
We've already broken moved behind the curtain here. That's the relationship.
Sometimes mental health, it's a big stigma. You think of like someone who may be in a psych ward or something like that. But just everyday life challenges. We want to have those conversations of how can mental health affect you if you have a physical illness, you go to a doctor. So we want to make sure, normalize it, that like, okay, if I'm having some financial stress, if I'm having postpartum, if I'm having, you know, a life transition, who can I talk to, and is this normal? What are the red flags, green flags, and when I should talk to someone?
The first installment, I call it an installment, the first conversation, trauma-informed care?
Yes.
Let's break that down. I mean, in some ways the term has its own meaning, but I want to make sure that we get the meaning across here. What are we talking about?
We want to let the community know that, and we want to provide a safe space in the community. We want to increase the community to be a safe space for mental health to be discussed, to empower individuals who do come out and say, I need therapy, I need to talk to someone, to give them the opportunity to create us the knowledge that they gain from it and be able to share it within a community and to collaborate with others. So once you realize, you know, I need a safe space where I can come and talk to somebody, I'm dealing with a lot of trauma from my past and I don't know where to channel that, we give them that opportunity to build trust within the community, within our organization and the community, and have peer support. So once they learn it's okay to deal with whatever you're dealing with, whatever trauma you have, that they can help other people who are in the same boat deal with it.
Yeah.
When I saw trauma-informed care, and I couldn't overlook that you're going to be at the Exchange at Beverly Gray,
uh-huh.
Which is literally a stone's throw from right. the Jefferson Avenue Tops.
Yes.
And of course, we're coming up on the anniversary of 5/14/2022. I'm wondering if you can maybe give me some of your impressions about how that, if in fact that event is still impacting the community. What can you tell me without, obviously you don't want to be breaking, you know, privacy issues here, but what right. can you tell me what you're seeing and hearing?
I'm glad that you brought it up because I know 5/14 was a big driving factor of why we really honed in on our business and mm-hmm. pushed the conversation of mental health. She was right there on the scene providing mental health services to people who were impacted. And even over the years, it's a few years away, but the community still feels it. You yes. still feel that trauma there. And then how do we have those conversations, especially in this polarized environment? We want to make sure that, one, with this conversation that we're doing, we wanted to make sure that it was accessible so people can get there. It's right there, right at Jefferson and East Utica. Right. We wanted to make sure it's accessible to that community, but everyone else as well, but yeah. Very focused on that community. We wanted to make sure that it's affordable. So the first one is free. The other ones are $10 because we want to make sure that people are invested in coming.
Sure.
But we don't want it to feel like, oh, I can't afford to come and I really need to be here.
Right. Right.
And we also have talk with Zanetta Everhart, who her son was part of it mm-hmm. and dealt with it, and this is her district and her passion is so strong in that district and regarding the 5/14 situation. So we have talked to her and we've partnered with her as well
for her Black Caucus last yes. year. We did some tabling. We
and
also are part of the Black Mental Health Response Team through
yes.
Best Self Behavior Health. So we've been in the community providing services because, and some of it is non-traditional services because mm-hmm. we really want to help people be able to access us and then kind of get there, open the door to say, hey, I want to talk to someone and it wasn't so bad. And then they may build that trust to say, oh, this is really what's going on with me or this is how it's impacting me.
And you mentioned, as you were talking about it, polarized environment. In this polarized environment, I know what when I hear that, I know what I'm thinking, this national political philosophical divide that we yeah. have. Uh-huh. That's what you're referring to? That's you're seeing that play out?
I see that, but I also see it's a racial disconnect. I know it's hard to talk about race now with the national climate.
Sure.
We don't want to say it's a disproportionate impact, but for things like this, especially when you think about 514, it is a racial factor to it.
No doubt.
And so we really want to talk about the elephant in the room when we are in spaces, because sometimes you're just scared to bring it up because you don't know how other people are going to respond.
Yeah, how it's going to affect them. But for the 514, when that incident happened, it was very limited clinicians of color.
Right.
So I had already started walking through solutions, but it really, for Deja, for myself being there, and for Deja, we just like, we got to do something different.
We need to do more, yeah.
This community needs clinicians of color. They need clinicians, period. So,
but it's so important, right? It's so important to have, right? We heard about that right after 514.
Yes.
There were a lot of people were seeking counseling and just the opportunities to meet somebody who looked like themselves,
right,
who understood their experience, just wasn't there.
Right. And that's what the people said they wanted.
Sure.
So we did a lot of listening to see what the needs were, and that was a big outpour after 514, is they want to see people that look like them.
Yeah, because they had a lot of support. Like, crisis services came out. They had a lot of support, but it was just with that specific situation, they really needed to be able to open up and be vulnerable with someone that they felt looked like them.
And are you seeing that in your other, I mean, you guys are involved in a lot of different efforts, and but are you seeing that people are coming to terms that they feel safe, that they're able to express maybe some of these thoughts about, you know, race and trauma?
I think so. I think with a lot of the clients that we have been engaged with, they have been able to open up, and we've been more open because we've worked, you know, we've been in the field for so long. And I think anybody who is a therapist can help, but I think we have to build the trust. You know, you need to be able to open up and trust a therapist, because all the work is coming from you. It's not coming from the therapist. They're just guiding you.
I can appreciate that. But as you were saying that, I'm going to dig a little personal here, and you can avoid this if you want, or dodge, or just tell me that you don't want to talk about it. But yeah, I'll go for it. But you are the therapist, and you were there at 514.
Yes.
How about for you? How do you process that?
Well, for me, it was really, really hard because when people did get me to come in, you know, when they came into my office, it was less like a relief for them, because they felt like they weren't hurting anybody just from being angry as it was a racial incident. So for me, I was like, I just really wanted to be there for them. It was hard for me because, you know, you're like, wow. And so I think I did struggle with that, because I'm like, you know, where are the clinicians of color? Because they need to be here. They need to be able to hold on to these people who have just dealt with this. So I think it was hard. I know it was hard. It was really hard for me, but I also appreciated everyone that came out, because they weren't like, okay, it doesn't have anything to do with color. I just want to be here to help you.
So the support made a difference.
Yes, yes.
That's great to hear. I think that was one of the things. We saw a lot of activity on Jefferson for a month, 2 months, and it obviously continued, but it went away. But at least that initial support, that show of support, did have benefits.
Right. And it stayed with us. That was like, oh, we got to really make walking through solutions, because this is a problem and we need to find a solution. And I think it made us reach out to other clinicians of color as well that we have connect with, and, you know, try to keep them on a path.
And more collaborations for referrals, just that relationship building. And that's what we do in all of our professional spaces. But when we have someone that has a need, we've been able to get a lot of opportunities where bigger organizations are being more responsive to the need of people saying, I would like someone that is from this background or that background. I mean, it may be it's religious preferences. It's all different preferences.
Okay, that's a good point, yeah.
But when it came to race, a lot of times that wasn't something that they would make a conscious effort to say, oh, you want someone, you know, from your racial background. So now they built more of these directories.
Yes.
That Brown Bag, they launched their Black Wellness Directory a few months ago. And that has like all different, it's not just therapy, they have like yoga, they have like all different like wellness services that's provided by people of color, if that's what you're looking for.
Right.
Are we seeing, are we seeing more people though of color perhaps finding their way into this profession? Or not necessarily seeing that yet?
I would say from our two, so we have two interns of color.
Okay.
That we had this year. Mm-hmm. And we've asked them, because I know when I went to grad school a few years ago, it was two of us, three total in my classes. And that was kind of interesting, because when you think of social work, I think it's a noble profession, but it doesn't, you don't always think like, oh, it's as competitive as like going to like medical school or something like that. Yeah, or law school. You're like, okay.
You would know.
You were like, if you're interested in it, you should have the opportunity. But then when you look at like, well, why aren't there, you know, people of different communities being accepted, whether it's, you know, Black, Asian, Hispanic, all those things, the diversity just wasn't there. And that's what made me think like, is there some systemic barriers? Is there a lack of access, a lack of awareness of like, this is something that people want? Do people want to do this? And do they have the opportunity to do it?
Right.
Are there barriers?
Some of it, I mean, social work is an extensive program. You have to do an internship. So you have to do two internships. You're doing 16 hours a week, and it's unpaid.
Mm.
So that's on top of your graduate classes. Uh-huh. So when you think of it, that's a full 4-day week of not being paid. Can you afford to do that for 2 years? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah,
right.
Especially if you have a family, you have to work. You know, so it's like, where do I find a time to work, to do my internship and to do my papers, my schoolwork that's needed, and attend classes?
And the starting salaries for some social workers, at least when I graduated, I was like, I could work at Burger King and make more than this.
Come on.
I think the conversation is shifting, and you see more agencies making more investment because they want you to have a master's degree. They want you to have a license. And you're like, well, if I have to have all of this, I should get paid.
Sure, professionally.
So I think it is changing. I think as a society, we're making more of an investment in mental health globally, but it's still work to go.
Yeah, because I graduated 21 years ago, and we had less than a handful of minorities in our graduating class as well. So for her to say it was like a few, we pretty much the same.
Well, that could have a whole conversation about change and what hasn't changed, right? But we're gonna continue our conversation this morning on What's Next. With us, Deja Middlebrook and also LaShawn Davis. They are with Walking Through Solutions. We're talking about their Walking Through Solutions Wednesdays. You mentioned how you're also working with other businesses, other entities as well. Who are some of those that are going to be helping you out and taking part in these conversations?
Okay, well, we mentioned the UB School of Social Work, who's partnered with us.
Yep, so our two students, we have Charmy Rainey and we have Siobhan Walton. Mm-hmm. I think Siobhan is graduating this year, right?
Yes, she's a part-time student, though, so I think they're both graduating at the same time.
Okay,
just at a different rate of speed.
Mm-hmm. So we have them two. They're going to be leading the conversation on May 7th at 5:30 at the Exchange at Beverly Gray. Session two is titled New Baby, New Problems. We're partnering with Sharnice McMillian Martin. She's a doula. She's specifically a postpartum doula. So we want to have her talk about the benefits of having a doula in general, because a lot of people aren't really familiar with why you should have or why you could have one. What would be the benefits? But also that postpartum journey, that's what really links it to our mental health.
Right.
Our mental health mission is like how to navigate and how they could be helpful and what, you know, what's normal to navigate in those environments.
Let me just follow up then. So since you're dealing with some of your clients, the people that you have, they're dealing with postpartum issues.
Yes. We also do a women's group that we do yearly. And we also do some like
in March.
Yeah. Okay. For the Air Force as well. But they as far as postpartum, I'm sorry. We talk about how it affects women, not just women, how it affects the husband, the father, the family. So I think we invite everyone to come in, because it's not just the person who is going through it, it's the surrounding team around them.
And we also wanted to broaden the people that may be interested, is because you may be a grandparent, you may be a sister, right, a brother, you know, so, and then just generationally, things are different. How you raise your kids, you know, how she raised me versus how I raised my kid is different. Right. Just because how we've evolved as a society. So just having that resource and have our expert come in, Sharnice McMillian-Martin, to say, this is what my role is as a postpartum doula, and then these are the things that people sometimes go through, and just inviting the new baby into the house, because it's a stranger in your house, you know.
Oh, it was strange, all right.
as a title, new baby, new problems.
All right, so that's right. So then we'll move on, and maybe we can have a conversation about each topic. Go right ahead. Okay. And
our next one, we have Money on the Mind, Reducing Financial Stress.
Whoa.
That'll be May 21st.
Yes. And that'll be May 21st at 5:30. And that's Melanie Hicks will be presenting.
Okay.
And she also has a book out that she'll talk about, but
Financial Sense.
And her goal is to help people understand budgeting, like how to budget, what to think about, how to figure out planning for it, a family, yourself, just for your retirement, all of it.
Credit. All of that. And then especially with this economy, with inflation and everything, like that causes a lot of stress that people don't really associate it with mental health. They associate it with, you know, work pressures. But that affects your mental health. So we want to bring that to the conversation.
Right.
And we'll have, you know, tailor it to mental health as well. But just to have that expert to talk about how can you reduce some of that financial stress.
Okay. All right.
And our next one we have is
May 28th.
And that is, are you struggling with life after loss? And we have Mercedes Godfrey, who's coming in, and she has a very unique, powering story that she will share. And she has other events that she does. She does grief counseling, and she is Keep On Walking.
Okay. All right.
And then our finale is June 4th, which is Male Vulnerability, Strength or Weakness. Mm-hmm. We'll have Rasheen Powell. Yep. So he's going to come, and he's the expert. He works with plenty of men, and he does his men groups that talks about vulnerability, manhood, all those things. So balancing that pressure, and then how to tune in and hone into your vulnerability. So that's for men, but it's also for women too, because we experience men. We want to make sure that if men are doing the work to become more vulnerable, we have to do the work to make sure that we're receiving it as well.
Right. We have to be open, and we have to know, once they open up to us and they're vulnerable with us, how can we receive it, and how can we encourage them to keep going? Keep on being vulnerable.
I appreciate the fact that, you know, you're bringing in a male speaker for this particular thing, but at the same time, you're counselors and you're talking with people. What are you hearing along that idea of male vulnerability? What, take us inside that a little bit, what you're learning, maybe.
I think with our boot camp, we learn a lot about it, because we have a lot of men who become very vulnerable at the boot camp.
Really?
And they open up, and a lot of women have never seen that side of them. So a lot of times they open up, and they don't know what to do with it once they are vulnerable to opening up. So what Rasheen does is he helps them understand how to show it, how it's being shown, you know, and what to do with it once you let it out. So I think we've learned a lot through just our boot camps, I think. And then we have individual counseling where men and women are vulnerable one-on-one. So we help them deal with, you know, whatever struggles they're going through, but they don't know how to do it in front of other people.
I was just going to say, it's one thing inside a private session, right, and then it's another to do it in a private session, even in your own home, right? There's a dynamic there that's not always easy to traverse, for sure.
Uh-huh.
We're talking with Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis from Walking Through Solutions, and their Walking Through Solutions Wednesday sessions that are coming up in the month of May and early June as well at the Exchange at Beverly Gray. I always interested to hear when you guys do come in to talk to me. It seems like you're always getting into something new and different and exciting. You're doing some work with the Air Force?
Yes.
What's that?
We have, they contracted us. They did come to, a person came to our women's group, loved it, and wanted to share it. And then another completely different person came to our boot camp, loved it. And they contract with us for us to come out and talk to some of the military, because they deal with a different stressor where if they're going overseas, or they may have to go and deal with whatever is going on outside of the United States, they need that support. And so we tapered our boot camp to address any issues that they may have. So we met with them at first and we talked about things that's going on in their relationships and their lives, and we altered our boot camp to make sure it fits their, you know, their unique structures.
The thing too, when you think about like the Air Force or just the armed forces in general, mm-hmm. they have a different culture. So the culture of being strong, but when can you turn it off? And then sometimes when you go home, that strongness of, you know, having your armor on doesn't always work at home. Right. And so you have to know how to transition, how to be soft at home with your partner when you need to be. And then also for your partner, how can they support you? Sometimes like, yeah, you're doing this great thing for our country, but like, maybe I'm at home and I'm juggling it all and I'm struggling. So how can we be on the same page? How can we support each other? How can we maintain our connection even when we may be in different physical spaces or just different emotional spaces and different seasons in our life? How can we maintain our connection and be the best we can be for our families and for each other?
Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to be safe in assuming here, but it sounds like people are reaching out more. They're finding walking through solutions.
Yes, they are. And I do want to give a great shout out to you guys because we have had a lot of referrals that say they heard our interview.
Oh, okay.
They so, were, yeah.
Yes.
We're like, how did you find us? They're like, oh, we heard you on NPR. I'm like, yes. You did?
Yes. Wow, how about that? Somebody is listening. Not just my relatives. So that's good news. Well, I'm obviously thrilled for that. But at the same time, if you're not delivering, uh-huh. you're not going to get those responses. So, yeah. So people are. I guess it's a good sign for you as a business yes. business people, but at the same time, it's a good sign when it comes to mental health, right?
Yes, yes. Because people are looking for something different, looking to learn more about it.
And the thing with us is we wear other hats. So we have, this is our micro enterprise, since it's just two of us. That's a new word I learned this week. We're a micro enterprise, under 10 employees. So when we go spaces, we go to places or even other, you know, things for our other jobs or things like that. People know that, oh, they do mental health. And so they ask us, or we'll, you know, have that perspective at the table. And we do a lot of community work. So when you think about the entrepreneurial side of it, social capital is really what helps you grow too.
Yes.
Money is always nice.
Money's nice, but.
I'll let you know if I ever get any. So how about then for the two of you then? Micro enterprise, it's a small firm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you deal with your own internal issues, if you don't mind putting it out there for us, speaking of being vulnerable?
I think we've grown a lot, and I had to do a lot more growing because Deja has always been my little girl. Mm. And as I've seen her grow into a young woman, but I was still mom. So now with the business aspect, and we get so many people that reach out to us because the generation gap, and we've actually lived it. So because we bump heads. Some things she experienced, and I'm old school, I didn't experience. So she does teach me, and then I also teach her, you know, everything isn't the way it looks. So I think we've grown together, and us growing and being vulnerable with our, whenever we do a presentation, I think it brings people in because they see that we're always learning.
And we live it. Like, we have these hard conversations. Like she said, like, at home, yeah, you're mom, and at work, I always respect you as my mom, but we're partners. So like, it's a different level of accountability when it comes to being a business partner versus being mom and daughter.
Right.
So just having those boundaries of like, okay, we had to get structured, and like when we have our like monthly meetings, so it's not just, oh, I was over for dinner and let's just talk. We can do that, but we need to have a structured time of like, this is really, you know, serious. So we're not having distractions and like, everyone else can just put your phone off, all of that, so that we can really get to the business of walking through solutions.
Right. And she's taught me a lot about social media, because that's something I'm like, I don't know how to do that. So she has pushed that. And I think just her being who she is, like, she's a magnificent person. So
people see her
and they're like, Deja. And before it was like, oh, LaShawn Davis. Now it's like, you're Deja's mom.
Also, and then like, so she's used to doing the one-on-one counseling, and now we're in a realm where we do more than just one-on-one. We're doing training, so we really have to put yourself out there when you're doing a training. It's like 20-30 people staring at you. So that area, I think it's been a period of growth for both of us.
Yeah.
So it's been great.
Yeah. Well, it's been great having you here with us again. It's Walking Through Solutions Wednesdays, and Walking Through Solutions, of course, is your micro enterprise. I'm going to be sitting on that one for a while. How do people find out more?
They can go to our website,
www.walkingthroughsolutions.org. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Instagram, and we're on LinkedIn. And you could connect with us too on LinkedIn to see what we have going on. Deja Middlebrook and LaShawn Davis.
Yes, we're posting all the time on social media.
Really?
Thanks to Deja.
and not to forget, the first Walking Through Solutions Wednesdays is coming up on Wednesday, May 7th.
Yes, May 7th is the first one. It's free. You can attend the full series, the 5-part series, for $40 if you want to come, or bring a friend, or if you want to sponsor someone that you think could benefit from these conversations. Mm-hmm. I strongly suggest doing that. And it's all in person at the Exchange at Beverly Gray.
Well, good luck, and as always, thanks for the great conversation.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, our guests from Walking Through Solutions, LaShawn Davis, licensed master social worker, and Deja Middlebrook, licensed master social worker, and now a JD, accredited person who passed the bar here in New York State. I know you got your ethics test, but I'm sure you'll ace that.
I will ace it.
I have very little doubt. And spoken like a true achiever as well. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members. And from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.